What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Kafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that inspires investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens to challenge consensus narratives and to learn how to think critically about the systems of power shaping our world. My guests in today's episode of Hidden Forces are Nicholas Danforth and Amberin Zaman. Amberin is a senior correspondent for Al Monitor, reporting from the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. And Nicholas is an editor at War on the Rocks and a senior visiting fellow at the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy. They join me today to discuss the significance of the recent electoral outcome in Turkey for Turkish politics, for the country's complex relationship to its neighbors and allies in Europe and the United States, and for the Turkish economy, which has been teetering on the edge of a balance of payments crisis with no easy solution in sight. While much ink has been spilled in Western press outlets covering the recent elections, the larger context of why Turkish politics matter to people outside the country has been lacking, in my view. We attempt to answer this question in the first hour of today's episode and devote the second part of our conversation to a discussion about Turkey's political future, its orientation towards the West, and what, if anything, the United States can do to improve relations with Ankara. If you want access to that part of the conversation, and you're not already subscribed to Hidden Forces, you can join our premium feed and listen to the rest of today's episode by going to hiddenforces.io/subscribe. All of our content tiers give you access to our premium feed, which you can listen to on your mobile device using your favorite podcast app, just like you're listening to this episode right now. If you want to join in on the conversation and become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, which includes Q&A calls with guests, access to special research and analysis, in-person events, and dinners. You can also do that on our subscriber page. And if you still have questions, feel free to send an email to info@hiddenforces.io, and I or someone from our team will get right back to you. And with that, please enjoy this timely and insightful conversation with my guests, Nicholas Danforth and Amberin Zaman. Nicholas Danforth and Amberin Zaman, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Likewise.
This is a first time for both you guys.
It is.
Yeah. Well, welcome. You both write about Turkish politics, which is why we're here. Nicholas, you're the editor at War on the Rocks, so you end up editing a lot of articles and stories dealing with all sorts of geopolitical issues, and you guys have really blown up in the last year.
Oh, good to hear.
No pun intended, with everything that's been going on in Ukraine and between Russia and Ukraine. But before we get into any of this conversation today, which is going to be primarily about Turkey, I would love for each of you to introduce yourselves. Amberin, why don't you go first? Tell us a little bit about who you are, how you got to doing what you do, and what do you do?
So my name is Amberin Zaman. I'm based in London. I'm originally from Turkey, and I'm a senior correspondent for Al Monitor. That's a Washington, D.C. based online news organization, which is relatively young. And we cover the Middle East and North Africa in depth. And what I do for Al Monitor is I travel across the Middle East and dig up stories and report from, you know, places like Syria, Iraq, Tunisia, Israel, and write mainly about politics. And before that, I used to be the Economist's Turkey correspondent for a very long time. And before that, used to write for the Washington Post, LA Times, VOA. I was a stringer for all of those publications in Turkey.
So you've seen a lot of changes, not just in Turkey, but in the Middle East over the last 20 years. Nicholas, what about you? What's your deal? How did you get into this line of work?
I started off writing a PhD about U.S.-Turkish relations in the 1940s and 50s. I mean, that was the period of time that Turkey became a democracy, that Turkey became a NATO ally. I started my research on it back in the late 2000s, and I didn't fully realize that by the time I finished, both of those features of Turkey would be kind of up for grabs in a way that I didn't really anticipate. Then after I finished my PhD, I switched to doing think tank work in Washington. I've covered U.S.-Turkish relations in sickness and in health, mostly in, you know, increasing sickness for a range of different think tanks. And then, switched to editing at War on the Rocks, where I've been delighted to get to still work on Turkey, but also a host of other issues, including, as you said, a lot of stuff on Russia and Ukraine, in the past year and still enjoy the opportunity to talk about Turkey when it comes up.
So I was telling you guys before we started that one of the things that I find kind of both surprising, because it's such an opportunity, and frustrating is the lack of context that exists in the broader media ecosystem around the subject of Turkey. It's similar to how the press talked about MBS. They kind of get obsessed about certain personality types. Turkey has Erdogan. He's a big populist guy. That's a through line also to America's rise in populism and Trump, et cetera. And what I think gets lost is the answer to the question, why should I care, for the average American or even European that's watching? I mean, it's less true for Europe. I mean, I understand, you know, I'm actually recording this episode from Greece. I'm a Greek citizen, and it's obviously relevant to Greece. But if you are sitting in the United States, why should you care about the recent elections in Turkey and what happens to the country overall? Amberin, why don't you take that question first, and then Nicholas can give his take on it.
Well, my answer will be more of a boilerplate one. I mean, all you need to do really is to look at the map to realize why Turkey matters. It's sitting on prime strategic real estate at the intersection of Europe, the Middle East, the Caucasus, the Aegean, the Eastern Mediterranean. You know, Turkey matters in so many different ways. And of course, most immediately now we're seeing that play out in the Ukraine conflict, where the position Turkey takes is of critical importance. And so thanks to Turkey, for example, we have this Black Sea grain deal that allows Ukraine to continue to export its wheat and therefore to head off a global food crisis. For example, what Turkey does in places like Syria, in Iraq, in the Caucasus, actually changes the course of history. We just saw that happen like a couple of years ago in Armenia, when after like 30 years, suddenly within the course of 2 months, Turkey's military assistance to Azerbaijan completely changed, altered the calculus there, where Azerbaijan was able to reclaim all its occupied territories and is now, in fact, trying to get more from Armenia. And obviously, why should the United States care? Because Turkey is a major NATO ally. And we've seen this NATO ally now playing with Russia. You could say growing closer to it, depends on how you look at things. But obviously, much more involved with Russia. There's obviously a kind of bro thing going on between Putin and Erdogan. And we saw Putin step up to the plate for Erdogan ahead of these elections by deferring Turkey's debt for natural gas that it imports in very large quantities from Russia, for example, by injecting billions of dollars in cash to the Turkish central bank, helping to prop up the lira. And of course, you know, the United States obviously cares that Turkey is developing this very sort of this deep, increasingly deep relationship with Russia. You know, it's always about not wanting to lose Turkey. Nicholas may have a different view on that. Perhaps people in Washington care less about losing Turkey and have different plans. But I think that at the end of the day, Turkey has always historically been, in various different iterations, an extremely important country. And for as long as there's no great tectonic shift and Turkey remains where it is physically, it will continue to play a very important role. And one last point, obviously for Europe too, you know, Turkey is holding the floodgates for millions of refugees that Europe doesn't want within its own borders.
So Nicholas, I'd love for you to respond as well, but please also address Amberin's point about losing Turkey. What does that mean, losing Turkey?
Well, it's a tribute to how much Turkey matters geopolitically that whatever incarnation of U.S.-Turkish relations we're going through, whatever is happening in Turkey's domestic politics, there always is a strong interest in Turkey in Washington. It's something that certainly struck me writing about the country over the last two decades. I agree with you right now that narrative is very much focused on Erdogan's populism, on what that means for the world. But, you know, the fact is at every stage, and I can talk about this going back to the 1950s if we want, you know, there's been editors, politicians, folks watching the world from Washington have had one reason or another to focus on Turkey. One way or another, Turkey has been at the center of a lot of narratives and a lot of debates that we're trying to have in Washington. You know, so again, in the early 2000s, when people were much more optimistic about what was happening in Turkey, when Turkish EU accession was on the table, when Turkish democratization really seemed like a real prospect, you know, that was important to people here, again, for the very concrete geopolitical reasons that Ambarin outlined, but also because in the aftermath of 9/11, the question of, you know, a predominantly Muslim country that was a close U.S. ally was of crucial importance to people. The question of democratization in Turkey, I mean, at the end of the Cold War, when you had this moment where you really thought that liberal values were going to spread across the world, when U.S. policy really hinged on taking this liberal international order that we've been trying to create and had been stifled for the course of the Cold War and expanding that into something truly global, Turkey's democratization, Turkey's ability to go from, you know, a country that was seen as a very incomplete or problematic democracy to a real entrenched European-style democracy was in a lot of ways, and I think quite rightfully, at the heart of the discussion of whether or not, you know, that vision for a more liberal democratic world could take hold. And unfortunately, I think as that vision has faltered around the world, and it certainly has faltered in Turkey, you know, the flip side of that, people were analyzing the country from an optimistic lens. Now, you know, as you said, it's the story of populism, it's the story of nationalism, it's the story of religion, and it's Erdogan's ability to channel all those things and turn those things against the West that's become, you know, on an ideological level, central to this question of whether democracy can expand, but also at a political level, you know, these debates about whether or not what we're going to see or what we were going to see was a kind of U.S.-dominated liberal international order expanding across the world, or whether we're going to see increasing pushback to that, whether we're going to see more and more countries that didn't envision themselves as part of that world joining forces to push back against it. And that's to get to your question about losing Turkey. I think why these debates have such resonance right now, it's, you know, it's not just the practical side of Turkey's cooperation with Russia as it relates to Ukraine, although clearly that's huge, but the bigger question of, you know, is a country that's been a NATO ally for 70 years going to stay one? Is this configuration something that's going to last and deepen, or is it going to be thrown in reverse? There are clearly a lot of people in Turkey who do want to throw that in reverse, Erdogan most prominently, but also, you know, both his allies and opponents. And so it's, you know, for very specific but also much broader reasons, a question that, you know, understandably, I think folks in D.C. are very focused on.
Yeah, I love how both of you guys addressed that, because Ambarin focused more on the geostrategic element, which is where Turkey is located and why it's always been an important geopolitical foothold, either because of its role as a gateway for trade between the empires or as a gateway to Europe. But also, I think this other framing of like autarky or authoritarianism versus democracy is a really interesting one, because, and also East versus West, because Turkey kind of straddles both worlds, but it's had a more Western orientation since the time of Kemal Atatürk. And so is it correct, let me ask it this way, is this question of losing Turkey less about whether or not Turkey will remain compliant ally of the United States, because that seems to be less and less true. Turkey seems to want to exercise strategic autonomy, whether it's in its dealings with the U.S. or with the United States. But is it less about that, and is it more about where it would fall ideologically, so that in this new world that's coming together, we can work with the Turks on shared interests, but what we worry about more is whether we'll be able to work with them on shared values. Is that really the right way to think about it, guys?
I don't think so, no. I'm profoundly cynical about the way the United States approaches Turkey and any other country for that matter, very much narrowly defined by how it perceives its own national interest. And I think that's played out for decades. You know, if the United States were so concerned about values, why the hell was it saying nothing when, you know, the Turkish army was burning its way through southeast Turkey, razing villages to the ground, feeding Kurdish villagers their own excrement? And, you know, where were the values then? As I said, I think I tend to go with your first argument, which is that essentially the United States is worried that it's losing leverage over Turkey, that yes, it is less and less able to have Turkey align with its own policies. And I mean, this, you know, we already saw that quite distinctly during the occupation of Iraq, when the United States wanted to send troops through Turkey to Iraq. And, you know, Erdogan was game, but then his party wasn't. Mm-hmm. And that whole thing sort of fell through. But, you know, earlier you could cite Cyprus as an example where, admittedly, it was a left-wing government that went against U.S. policies. But I think this is, you know, as Turkey flexes its muscles and finds, you know, it becomes more confident, and it certainly has grown extremely confident under Erdogan, it's going to be less and less easy for the U.S. to get Turkey to do its bidding, to put it very crudely. But equally, you know, I think it's also to do with the fact that the Europeans have forfeited quite a bit of leverage as well, particularly when it comes to human rights and democracy, A, because they've been profoundly hypocritical in their approach to Turkey, starting full membership talks with them only to have Merkel and Sarkozy announce the next day practically that, well, by the way, guys, you know, you're never going to be members of the EU because you're too large, you're too Muslim. And also now it's just sort of purely transactional where the European Union gives Turkey lots of cash in exchange for keeping all these sort of unsightly, you know, quote unquote, brown Muslim and other people they don't want within their borders. So, you know, okay, Erdogan can be quite awful, but then, you know, who is our moral compass? Which country today?
Nicholas, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, what I'd add is that when things were going well and for Turkey and for the U.S.-Turkish relationship, it was always a very nice example for people to point to of all our values and interests lining up, that here was a country that had become culturally pro-Western, that was secular, that at the same time was a U.S. ally within NATO, and was also democratic. And so it was convenient for everyone, I think, who wanted to see or who believed in this kind of idealistic version of U.S. foreign policy, doing well by doing good around the world, to have Turkey as an example of all the things we liked lining up, you know, pro-Western, democratic, pro-American in a geopolitical sense. And, you know, in moments that worked, but when you start looking at, you know, the specifics, you know, again, for the last century, they never quite line up as well as people wanted them to. And as Amberin pointed out, you know, sometimes they quite dramatically diverge. My research was on the 1950s when Turkey joined NATO. And one of the really popular assumptions that's come out of that, you know, Turkey joined NATO and it became a democracy at the same time. And that looked good for everyone. And so it was very easy for people to say, and people in Turkey and in the United States, you know, that was a precondition for joining NATO. The United States put pressure on Turkey to democratize in order to join NATO. And when you dig into the details, that's not what happened. The United States made it quite clear that Turkey could go on being an authoritarian government. It could join NATO because we needed them against the Soviets. In 1948, Portugal, under the quasi-fascist Salazar government, joined NATO. People in Turkey realized that. They knew they didn't have to democratize to get the benefits of a U.S. alliance. They did for their own reasons. We can talk about that. I think that's a real credit to the people who were in the Turkish government at the time. You know, but that was convenient. At the same time, you know, right, in the 1980, Turkey had a brutal military coup. It remained very loyal to NATO. And as a result, the United States didn't really have any issue with the lack of democracy. As it comes to, you know, secularism, pro-Western values, you were talking about MBS earlier. You know, Saudi Arabia has never been a particularly secular country, quite the opposite, never been an issue for U.S., you know,
well, so
U.S. government. So it's,
sorry, I was going to say, because I wanted to clarify a little bit when I talked about shared values. I draw a distinction between America today versus America for most of its post-World War II history. America has become increasingly a crusader nation. And so it does feel like the values, the quote values of the U.S. system, play a larger role in greasing the wheels of international diplomacy or halting the process than they used to. Certainly, the shale boom enabled the U.S. to be tougher on Saudi Arabia, but they didn't necessarily need to be so hung up on those differences in values between the U.S. and the Saudis. It feels increasingly like the values conversation is a proxy for a set of insecurities about the durability of the liberal international order and the perceived need to defend the normative narrative around that, than it is a reflection of any genuine concerns over democracy or human rights. Does that resonate at all with either of you, that it's a different foreign policy perspective than what the U.S. had for most of its post-war history?
I'd be inclined to say that for most of, you know, as I said, I could go back to World War II looking at this. You know, there's always been a tension between the U.S.'s very idealistic values and the way, you know, the opportunistic way it's often engaged with the world. That's, I don't think, you know, surprising. I think some people see that as fine. Some people are very outraged about it. That tension has been consistent. And I do think we're in a cycle, particularly after the Trump presidency, where there was, you know, Biden coming in did put much more of an emphasis on values. And, you know, Saudi Arabia became a good example of that. It was somewhere where, you know, in this constant tension, in this kind of constant, you know, balancing act between values, nominal values, and actual interests, I guess what I'd say is it seemed like Trump swung, because he swung so hard towards a cold embrace of interests, there was a little bit of a reaction. There was more of a push for, you know, people to say in a very kind of emphatic way, you know, no, we have to stand up for values. And again, I think because Saudi Arabia was such a nice example, a lot of people on the Democratic side focused on that. But at the end of the day, Biden hasn't, you know, we're not embargoing Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but we pissed off MBS pretty bad. Go ahead, Amber, and then we'll move to the election.
Speaking to what you said about the sort of crusading side of things, absolutely, wasn't that what the whole occupation of Iraq was about?
I think that I would view I always viewed the democracy signaling in a more cynical way ahead of that invasion than I do today. I feel like somehow today, the U.S. is in a place where it's trying to do its best to either contain the fragmentation that's happening in the global order or to redefine it. And how do you really do that? And how do you really form an international coalition if you don't have a set of values that you can at least speak to? It's become more difficult because of the Iraq invasion and the cynicism that caused. But that was sort of I wasn't really good at articulating what I meant by shared values, but that's where I see the relevance
of
that today.
Well, I think Putin kind of rode to the rescue, didn't he? By allowing you to all coalesce about our good old fashioned values. And in that sense, yes, you know, how else can we explain this support for Ukraine? It's overwhelming and it's done in the right spirit. It's the right thing to do for sure. But of course, it doesn't escape people living in Turkey or elsewhere that this happens when it concerns people who are in Europe, who are white, who are Christian.
Is that, you think that this has to do with skin color, the invasion of Ukraine?
I'm saying that's the perception, you know. Where were the values when Assad was barrel bombing Syrians or gassing them?
But isn't there
a
bigger security threat to Europe with Russia invading Ukraine than there was with Assad?
Yeah, exactly.
Waging?
So it's about what matters to you most.
Sure.
You know?
Well, as I was saying with Turkey, I mean, I think Ukraine's another example where, you know, no U.S. policymakers and commentators are never more excited than when values and interests seem to line up so perfectly. And I think that's what always made Turkey a feel-good story in the past. And it's what makes Ukraine such an easy thing to focus on now, is that they genuinely do line up. I mean, it's not in any way being cynical about that as it comes to Ukraine, but just it is convenient to seize on these moments when everything is operating in lockstep.
Hmm. So let's at least touch on the elections. You know, what I did not want to do, and this is why we're recording this a day after the runoff election, I didn't want to contribute to like the whole media circus around the first round and what happened. And I really wanted to try and make this conversation about what does this mean going forward and why does it matter and why should anyone care? But let's at least touch on what happened for people that either aren't familiar or need an update. First of all, Erdogan won the runoff. So that's kind of common knowledge at this point. What were the main issues that people voted on in this election?
I mean, obviously, there were several issues, but it boiled down to what Erdogan wanted to make the issue. And he made it one of, you know, typical sort of identity politics. If I go, Muslims will be forced to uncover their heads again. If I go, there'll be gay marriages. You know, he went not him, but his lieutenants went as far as to suggest that if the opposition won, humans would be mating with animals, you know, this kind of thing. And obviously bringing in the Kurdish issue and painting the opposition as enablers of this terrorist group, as the PKK is labeled, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, and sort of using images of the opposition candidates superimposed on these guerrilla leaders, claiming that they were actually meeting and plotting, you know, and this would be a huge disaster for Turkish national security. And obviously also pulling in all the sort of prejudice about the United States, the usual narratives about how these powers are out to undermine Turkey and undo all the sort of good that Erdogan's done and how he's elevated the country, made it so powerful and, you know, so muscular and everybody fears Turkey, etc. So, yeah, that was kind of what it was about, when in fact it should have really been about the, you know, pocketbook issues. The Turkish economy is an absolute disaster. People can't afford onions, garlics, you know, it's that bad. So that speaks to, well, first of all, how good Erdogan is. He's a master at spinning these narratives. He's probably the best politician that Turkey's seen in its modern times. And that's why he's been around for over 20 years, uncontested, but also speaks to how poorly the opposition performed ultimately. It's not just that Erdogan controls the media, that, you know, he controls the judiciary. True, it's not a level playing field. But equally, I think the opposition proved itself to be extremely incompetent yet again.
Do you guys think that there is a almost like a sort of international appeal that populism and populist figures and sort of demagoguery has taken on, and also jingoism in the world today? And if that's true, how would you explain that? Because just to point it out here, what you're saying is that these culture war issues and the appeals to nationalism, which is runs very deep in Turkish society, and as you said earlier, Emberin, that in fact Erdogan is oftentimes responding to what his opposition is doing, pushing him further to the right on those issues. The fact that these dominated the conversation and not the economic questions, besides the fact that Erdogan is very, very skillful and the fact that he controls so much of the media, or he has so much influence over it, how much of this is just some broader appeal that's happening internationally that we still don't really understand the sources of?
I mean, it certainly does seem to be something that's happening internationally. The similarities, as people have been pointing out for a while now, right, between the way these kinds of political appeals work in countries around the world really is striking. I haven't heard a particularly good, you know, and it'd be fair to say, you know, nationalism's been a big thing for a century or two now. It's not like that appeal has ever disappeared. Identity politics, religion has certainly been something that's, you know, even as we talk about how Western Europe or the United States has become more secular over the last couple centuries, you know, religion still has a big appeal to people. So I don't want to exaggerate how new any of this is. But as you say, I mean, it certainly does seem like the last decade or so, these themes, similar combinations of these themes, have had a very striking resonance in very different countries, you know, countries with different religions, countries with different histories, countries with different relationships to, you know, the West, to, you know, political and military power. You know, and I can rehash the explanations other people have given, which all seem, you know, relatively plausible. After the Cold War, kind of left-right economic debates didn't resonate with people as much, you know, and amongst dramatic shifts in society, appeals to kind of traditional values had a newfound resonance for people. That certainly seems plausible. The internet has brought out a lot of negative things in a lot of negative places, made it easier to for people to segment themselves into smaller or more niche political communities. All of that, you know, all that seems plausible to me, but I can't
give them more. It does seem like, yeah, I just did an episode. Actually, I should also mention, because we've mentioned now Syria, I mentioned that I was here in Greece. We've done two episodes with Joshua Landis, one dedicated to Syria, one where we touched on it, and another one with Jake Hanrahan on Syria, and one with Ryan Holiday on the Eastern Mediterranean and Turkey, Greece, and also one with Soner Çaptay on Erdogan, so people are interested. But I just did a recent episode with Tara Isabella Burton on her book, Strange Rights, which is about the rise of new religious movements in America. and self-made. And it does seem like there's a kind of vacuum of values and identity in the world. And in that place where we're not so clear on the story that we tell ourselves about who we are and what we believe and what we care about. And in those types of vacuums, there are opportunities for this kind of messaging to resonate with people, maybe because of a sense of rudderlessness around what are we in this thing together for? Is that something you guys ever think about? Does that resonate?
Yes and no. I mean, it's a neat way of describing what's happening in places like the United States, in Britain here, where I am with Brexit, Turkey, obviously. We just saw your election in Greece. Yeah, but ultimately every country, every society is different. And so I just don't think that in Turkey's case, it tells the whole story. Absolutely not.
So Nicholas, if you have anything to add, go ahead. And then I want to ask you guys about the Turkey's economy and the state of that economy, because that's something that was, again, not as powerful an issue in determining the outcome of this election, but it's one that's going to linger on after going forward now that Erdogan's elected. And there's a lot of questions about whether he's going to use this mandate to reverse some of his policies like Xi Jinping did with zero COVID, or if he's going to double down, especially in light of the fact that we have local elections coming up in, you know, not even a year. So feel free to respond to that. And then let's talk about the economy.
No, I mean, I'll quickly give, this is more of a non-response than a response. I mean, looking around the world today, I completely agree with you. I mean, it does seem like a lack of strong, ideological contenders that appeal to people, that give them some sense of meaning, is a big part of what's happening. But then when you look back at history, I mean, there's, at every age, it does seem like at every step, people are wrestling with that. And so I guess that it just reframes the mystery of why this particular set of answers is having an appeal now. And at every stage, there was that sense of rudderlessness. At every stage, people put forward a set of answers that were supposed to fulfill that, channel that sense of meaninglessness into political direction. And I guess that's the point, for centuries now, none of them have quite done the trick. And so we keep trying new options in this, we're in a new phase of it, clearly, but what explains the particular appeal of the particular things that are trying to answer that question now? I wish I had a better answer. Mm.
So I mentioned Turkey's economy. What is the economic situation in Turkey right now? Which one of you would like to tackle that first?
Well, I always hated writing about economics, even though I was the economist correspondent for 16 years. But I mean, in a nutshell, the situation is pretty bad. And there are several reasons for it. But the one that could be fixed is Erdogan and his obsession with low interest rates. And that's cited as one of the reasons that the Turkish lira has, been bleeding so massively over the past few years. And whether he will revert to economic orthodoxy or not, obviously the rule of law is an important part of this story because, when Turkey seemed like it was on the right path, you had masses of foreign investment coming in, and that's all gone now. And of course, you have very high inflation and you have a huge current account deficit. And, the country is burning through all of its reserves to keep maintaining, the lira where it is. And I think that's already looking very, very difficult. And as you pointed out, given that we have these local elections looming in March and that Erdogan is determined to get back Istanbul, which is so key to sustaining his own rule, because that's where all the rent is dispersed. That's where the contractors are given their juicy contracts. And it's a key component pillar of his regime. It's hard to envision that he would revert to economic orthodoxy, though we hear rumors that he's trying to woo back his former finance minister, this guy who used to work in London as a banker, Mehmet Şimşek, and who was sort of the last defense against the crazy economics and who was basically fired because, wasn't doing Erdogan's bidding. He's now apparently being wooed back. And I guess if he agrees, I think it would be mad for him to do that. But if he does, I guess that's sort of supposed to signal at some level that, guys, we're going to do that. Maybe not as fast as you want us to, but guys, we're moving in that direction. I just don't know. But obviously, everyone's talked about the big bust For years now, I've heard about the big bust, how the Turkish economy is going to crash, and it hasn't. And there was a really great piece in the Financial Times. I mean, I haven't memorized it, but basically explaining why the fundamentals are still quite resilient in Turkey, you know, unlike places like Brazil. So it's allowed the Turkish economy to sort of not collapse in the way people have been predicting for so long. It does caveat that, saying, though, if he persists in this course, you know, we may actually see some kind of
balance of payments crisis. Can you clarify what you said about wanting to retake control, political control, through his party of Istanbul, which is the big metropolis in Turkey, and that would incentivize him not to return to orthodox economic policies? Can you explain that to me? Because aren't the people living in Istanbul the ones that are most strongly support returning to getting inflation down and returning to more orthodox economic policies? So explain that for me.
Well, I mean, if you keep pumping subsidies and you bump up people's salaries, as he was doing in the run-up to these elections, there are tons of people in Istanbul who would respond, you know, favorably to what he's doing. Don't forget that a lot of those people in Istanbul who live in these sort of towns that have emerged around in the periphery of Istanbul that are considered now as part of Istanbul are people who came from rural areas, and who the AKP network very instantly, you know, plugged into and helped. I mean, that explains the rise of Erdogan, of the AKP. Those are the people who actually support Erdogan. And I don't quite know what you mean when you say that these are the people who, you know, want to see a return to economic orthodoxy. I'm not sure that's true, just because the opposition won that election in 2019 doesn't mean that that's what was informing their choice. I think the crucial factor there was the Kurds who were being very ideological, actually, by responding to their party's call to back the opposition candidate. And it was all about protecting their own interests as Kurds and pursuing their own very narrow agenda of Kurdish rights. And so they will be key in these local elections, again, just because of, you know, the numbers, the demographics. And so the very interesting question then that poses itself is, what will Erdogan do to get those Kurds on his side? Because he's done everything to alienate them so far, and premised on the fact that nationally, they don't matter as much. And that's what we've seen play out in this last election. Nationalism is the winning card, nationalism with big dollops of Islam. And so this will be very interesting. And this is a worry, in fact, because it also suggests that there'll be a lot more suppression, repression of the Kurdish party, of Kurdish actors. So we'll see how that goes.
You know, sticking on this conversation about the economy, one of the things that I don't understand is how Erdogan has managed to, or the mechanisms through which he's been able to stimulate the economy. How much of this has been direct stimulus, like fiscal, and how much of it has gone through the banking system, and how exposed is the Turkish banking system to a rising interest rate environment if the Turkish government were to try to reverse these policies? In other words, how exposed are they to loans issued during this period of time where money was cheap?
My understanding of economics is sufficiently primitive. I am not going to weigh in on this
topic. We have you here for the geopolitics, Nick. What about you, Amber?
I was going to say, if you thought I was going to talk about economics, you were mistaken. But no, I mean, it looks bad. That's my, having talked to people who do know a hell of a lot more about economics than I do, that's certainly, you know, they've been sounding the alarm for a long time. It's never quite, you know, as Umbanin said, gotten as catastrophic as people predicted. That does seem to be because the government's been very good at figuring out ways to avoid the kind of catastrophe that's been prophesied. But then, you know, people do say all of those measures come at a cost and simply increase the risk that when things go wrong, they will go very, very wrong.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to go ahead.
No, I mean, I just, because we were talking about the authoritarianism versus democracy and how that relates to interests versus values. You know, what's so striking to me is that you know, international investors clearly aren't, you know, ideological about things. They don't care if a country's democratic or authoritarian. If an authoritarian government is in place that's running the economy well, international investors are usually happy with that. The problem with authoritarianism is you don't always know what you're going to get. And if you get an authoritarian leader like Erdogan, who has, you know, very particular destructive ideas about how to run the economy, you know, well, they're the authoritarians and no one can actually push them, you know, stop them from going on the course that they want to go, even as that drives the country into the ground. You know, and so I think part of it, even when you're talking about Erdogan trying to bring back someone like Mehmet Şimşek, who would have a lot of credibility, who clearly knows how to run an economy well, you know, the fear is that even if Erdogan brought him back, if Erdogan didn't let him do what he thought he needed to do, you know, again, it's going to be Erdogan's call to make. It's not like he's going to give him, you know, defer to him necessarily. And so I just, at that level, the political structures that are in place in Turkey aren't conducive.
Wasn't his son-in-law the finance minister, or was he the foreign minister?
Yes.
Finance minister.
There you go.
He's the one who burned through all of the reserves trying to prop up the lira.
Yeah, so I was going to say, Nicholas, before I started to interrupt you, I'm not going to ask you about the special savings accounts and how those work and whether or not the Turkish government has the ability to make good on those claims in the event of a balance of payments crisis, which is kind of, it's a weird thing that people would, I don't know how the government's been selling it, so I won't ask you about that. So another question that I had, I mean, we kind of started to talk about this, but I had a set of questions about it because it's always interested me to understand to what degree the saber rattling that goes on in Turkish politics, to what degree that is simply just signaling as part of the culture war, and to what degree it represents real ambitious foreign policy objectives. You know, we've talked about like strategic autonomy. We didn't talk in this episode about Mavi Vatan or the Blue Homeland, but that's also part of this. There's a deep literature of sort of geopolitical knowledge in Turkey that influences the foreign policy debate. To what degree are these going to be lasting issues that Turkey is going to try to implement as part of a revisionist history of its borders? Do either of you have thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I was just in Syria and I had very clear and present thoughts about that. It's very obvious to me that with this government, we're certainly going to continue to see Turkey flexing its muscles beyond its own borders. It's doing that in Syria, where it's, you know, there's a relentless campaign against the Kurdish-led administration there. They haven't been able to mount another large-scale invasion because basically the Russians didn't let them. But that's not to say that Turkey does not continually mount artillery strikes, drone strikes, that is really, you know, wearing at the fabric of that sort of self-administration there and causing harm to civilian infrastructure, killing civilians and making life generally very difficult. And the same goes for northern Iraq, where Turkey is also fighting the PKK and has been expanding its military presence very steadily. More and more encroachment, you see, of Iraqi Kurdistan, where you now have Turkish troops fanned across the length of that border. And of course, that's very concerning to the central government of Iraq. It's a sovereignty issue. Yet, it, you know, despite all these calls that they keep making on Turkey to withdraw, Turkey is not. And there's no power around to make them withdraw. I mentioned earlier on about what happened in Azerbaijan and Karabakh. Again, another manifestation of Turkey matching its words with real action. And having just been in Armenia, well, just a couple of months ago, again, there, the fear was that Turkey would be helping Azerbaijan now land that would allow Azerbaijan to connect its enclave, Nakhichevan, that borders Turkey, with Azerbaijan proper. To many Armenians, that's a very clear and present danger threat. And I'm sure sitting where you are in Athens, in Greece, people do worry. And of course, the future of Cyprus, I'd love to hear what Nick thinks, how long it's going to take before Turkey actually formally annexes northern Cyprus.
Nick, I want you to answer that. Let me just add that, well, let me ask it as a question. Am I wrong to distinguish, because I do, to distinguish between Rojava, northern Syria, and northern Iraq, and the eastern Mediterranean, because the first one represents a potential security threat for Turkey, the Kurds have always been an issue. And so I can justify the concerns there. The rhetoric around the Eastern Mediterranean feels much more about ambition and about territorial expansion and reworking borders than it does about addressing security concerns. Would you agree with that, Amberin? And Nick, feel free to respond.
Yeah, I absolutely do agree with that. But I would also contest the justification on the grounds that certainly in the case of Rojava, that it poses a security threat. I understand sitting in Ankara, it is very disconcerting to see your NATO ally, the United States, arming, training, you know, living cheek and jowl with people who had senior positions inside the PKK and who ostensibly were in the field targeting Turkish soldiers, yes. But as things currently stand, that's a, you know, Rojava is a different theater. Their target is not Turkey. They have not attacked Turkey. They've held defensive positions by and large and have spent a lot of their human capital, in fact, fending against jihadi groups that have been empowered, enabled, armed by Turkey. And jihadi groups, Islamic State, Jabhat al-Nusra, now Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which claims to be not anti-American anymore, but yeah, who have threatened, you know, Europe, have gone and struck the heart of Europe.
Nick?
What strikes me about Erdogan's aggressive rhetoric, be it directed against Kurds in Syria or against Greece, is that people always try to parse it, or at least in Washington, people sometimes try to parse it as, you know, is this for domestic consumption or is this real? And what always strikes me is, look, I mean, it's, I think Erdogan genuinely thinks this aggressive approach to the world is good for Turkey's strategic interests, and it's clearly good for him domestically. I mean, I don't think he necessarily sees it as a choice. And that's alarming to the extent, I mean, yeah, clearly given recent Turkish history, it makes more sense with all the caveats that Umberin added, why the focus on Kurds in Syria is much more real or should be much more real to people in Ankara. But yeah, I don't know, but given the way U.S.-Greek relations have developed recently, what worries me is that I do think Turkey has kind of started to see the U.S.-Greek relationship in the same terms that it sees the U.S. relationship with Kurdish fighters in Syria. You know, that there really is this deep-seated belief in Ankara that the U.S. is conspiring with Turkey's enemies to try to, at the very least, contain Turkey, you know, maybe bring Turkey down, destroy it, dismember it, topple Erdogan. And that, you know, was clearly manifested for people in Ankara in the relationship with the Syrian Kurds. You know, but again, you have the cyclical self-perpetuating thing where as U.S.-Turkish relations get worse, U.S.-Greek relations have gotten better. That seems to be a good thing for the United States and for Athens. But, you know, obviously the threat perception in Ankara, especially when people there kind of very much downplay Turkey's own role in making and driving this dynamic, you know, is that they see the U.S. and Greece getting closer. You know, the U.S. is developing a base in Alexandroupolis, which from Washington's perspective is clearly aimed at more effectively transporting supplies into Eastern Europe, into Ukraine, especially given that they're not sure what their access through the Bosphorus is going to be like. But Turkey somehow sees this as a NATO base on Turkey's border that's going to be used to attack Turkey. Now, you can say that's crazy, given the United States already has bases within Turkey, but that threat perception seems to be real in Ankara, and it's dangerous.
Amber, and I see you nodding away while Nicholas was talking.
Yeah, I'm nodding away because I also think it's important to note that Erdogan does believe firmly that the Obama administration had a finger in that coup attempt against him.
Did the Obama administration have a finger, do you think?
I'll let Nick answer that. He's sitting in D.C.
No, I can confidently say the United States did not. You know, what I would say, and this is, as I said, I studied Cold War history, so I have to give this the little background. You know, the obsession in Turkey is that the United States was actively involved in sponsoring all of the coups that ever took place in Turkish history, even somehow the ones that were against U.S. interest. And again, I wonder, if you do Cold War history, you're like, yeah, the United States sponsored a lot of coups in the 50s in particular. And so it's not crazy for people to think that. You know, again, in the case of Turkey, since throughout most of the Cold War, either government that was in power was usually, especially at the beginning of the Cold War, pretty pro-American. The United States didn't actually have any reason to try to topple any of them. So in that sense, you know, again, not out of commitment to democratic values, but for much more realist reasons. It wasn't like the United States had to have coups in Turkey. I'm not saying they wouldn't have if they had to. But the fact, the damning fact, and this is where, again, the Obama administration was not involved in the most recent coup attempt in Turkey, full stop. The United States has worked every time there's been a coup in Turkey. The United States has very quickly begun working very closely with the military government that came in power through the coup. So while I think the conspiratorial belief that the United States was behind the scenes orchestrating these coups is false, the cynicism that that history has created, you know, if the coup hit against Erdogan had succeeded, would the United States have maybe waited a couple days to be polite and then sat down with the new military regime to talk about how they were going to coordinate against ISIS? Of course they would have. So in that sense, you know, I want to push back very firmly against the conspiratorial side of this, but also say I understand where the cynicism is coming from.
So guys, I'm going to move the rest of our conversation onto the premium feed. I would like to explore what the next 5 years have in store. You know, what version of Erdogan do you guys think we're going to get? What is his playbook going to be? And what is that going to mean for the future of Turkey and U.S.-Turkish relations? And then also, I'd like to the extent that we have the time to do this, discuss what the U.S. can do at this point. First of all, what is America's approach right now to this part of the world? And what can the U.S. do, if anything, to rehabilitate its image? Because Ambrin brought this up a number of times. Of course, we have the invasion of Iraq. That was a huge turning point in U.S. relations, and it really created an environment. It embedded a sense of cynicism around U.S. foreign policy and when we talk about values. And it undermined the international institutions that now we supposedly lament losing. So that's what we're going to talk about in the second part of this conversation, guys. For anyone who is new to the program, Hidden Forces is listener-supported. We don't accept advertisers or commercial sponsors. The entire show is funded from top to bottom by listeners like you. If you want access to the second part of today's conversation with Nick and Ambarin, head over to hiddenforces.io/subscribe and sign up to one of our three content tiers. All subscribers gain access to our premium feed, which you can use to listen to the rest of today's conversation on your mobile device using your favorite podcast app, just like you're listening to this episode right now. Guys, stick around. We're going to move the rest of our conversation onto the premium feed. If you want to listen in on the rest of today's conversation, head over to hiddenforces.io/subscribe and join our premium feed. If you want to join in on the conversation and become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, you can also do that through our subscriber page. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. You can follow me on Twitter at Kofinas, and you can email me at info@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.